Oliver, written by Riano D. McFarland. Chapter 1. If a wise man were fortunate enough to survive a gunfight in Virginia City, Nevada, during the height of the gold and silver rush in 1869, he would take that as a sign to pack up and move on, before the kinfolk of his adversary came looking for him. Unfortunately, there weren't many wise men who could simply call it quits after mining enough precious metal to provide for the next 5 generations of their descendants. No matter how much wealth they'd accumulated, the allure of silver and gold was like a grappling hook for most people mining or panning for it. There was never enough, and the temptation of going back for one final load had proven to be the disastrous ending for many a wealthy, yet greedy prospector. So often, that person lying face down in the road, bleeding out into an uncaring patch of dirt audacious enough to call itself Main Street, would soon be followed to Boot Hill by the lucky fool whose carefully measured 45 caliber chunk of lead had dropped him there. It was the ultimate irony, really, being undone and relieved of a sack of precious metal after being shot through the heart by that metal's most unprecious ugly cousin. Nevertheless, trading lead for silver and gold was a common and lucrative endeavor in the North American West during the late 1800s, with the victors of such confrontations often discovered face down behind the nearest saloon, after purchasing a celebratory round of drinks for the cheering patrons at the bar. There were innumerable unknown faces in western cities and towns that popped up overnight, and disappeared just as quickly. Many of them were referred to as stranger, and if they were smart, they stuck with that handle until they had safely returned with their bounties to their homes back east. Of course, there were those who fancied themselves as celebrities in their own minds, seeking glorified recognition for having been a fraction of a second faster than their opponents on one occasion or another. In addition to gunslingers like Billy the Kid, Butch Cassidy, John Wesley Hardin, and Clay Allison, there were countless others whose winning sprees culminated at one or two, before they also ended up face down on Main Street, with their pockets several golden ounces lighter. Names like the Rattlesnake Kid, Lightning Luke Kane, and Deadeye William Dodd were but flashes in the pan in the annals of history, holding on to their claims of fastest gun in the West, for as little as a week, to as long as 6 months, before being usurped of their titles. In the end, it was the speed of their tongues, rather than the quickness of their draw, that undid each of them. During the beginning of the California gold rush, prospectors would commonly share the details of their daily haul in pseudo-friendly competition with one another. That quickly changed when new arrivals, hoping to cash in on Mother Nature's hidden treasures, discovered that the most generous stakes had already been claimed, and the pitiful glitter yielded by panning the remaining streams and waterways was barely enough to pay for their daily bread. With the frustration of crossing the entire continent for a mere pittance of the wealth in the pockets of other prospectors, came the inevitable result of shattered dreams, desperation. Realizing they'd traveled nearly 3,000 miles to wind up penniless and unable to return to their previous lives, those desperate men took desperate measures, giving birth to the legend of the Wild Wild West. Despite the rampant lawlessness surrounding them, there were those who could resist the tempting siren songs of gold and silver. They came near the beginning of the rush, and with a clearly defined objective. Upon reaching that objective, they cashed in their treasures, took their money, and returned to their families and their lives in cities like New York, Boston, Chicago, and St. Louis. There, they could finance businesses, invest in lucrative innovative opportunities, or simply live out the remainder of their lives in peace and comfortable quiet. For 5 years, one unremarkable stranger had kept to himself. He worked hard and in isolation after staking a bountiful claim that produced copious amounts of silver and gold. He'd never bragged or disclosed the location of his mining bonanza, nor frequented Virginia City, until he was ready to cash out and go home. Due to the boom resulting from ongoing mining operations associated with the Comstock lode, Virginia City, Nevada was flush with cash, and able to purchase his substantial booty. The looks on the faces of the agents at the Virginia City Gold and Silver Exchange were a testament to the rarity of such a transaction being conducted by a sole individual. Unlike the company men who showed up each afternoon, surrounded by a posse of armed guards, this ordinary-looking stranger arrived first thing in the morning, on a wagon drawn by 2 mules, and left with nearly $500,000. 10 minutes later, most of that money was under the protection of Western Union agents, who handed the stranger a receipt for his wire transfer into an account in Boston, Massachusetts. For his eastbound journey, he kept a pouch of gold ore, and $1,000 in cash, however, there was nothing about him that would indicate either of those things were in his possession. It was still early, and before getting underway, he decided to have breakfast in a small restaurant across the street from the Western Union office. When he entered through the open front door, the handful of people inside gave him only a cursory glance before turning back to a frightened little girl sitting at a table in the far corner. Taking a seat on the opposite side of the restaurant, he stared out the window, telling himself, "It's none of my business." A few seconds later, a smiling woman approached with a large cup and a pot of hot coffee, asking, "Just coffee, or would you like to try some breakfast this morning? The biscuits just came out of the oven, and I'd be happy to get you a ham steak and some scrambled eggs to go with them." "That sounds perfect," said the man, nodding and smiling politely. "Well, my name is Luann, and I'll be right back," said the smiling woman before turning and heading back towards the kitchen. As he sat there sipping the aromatic coffee, the smell of the biscuits lingered tantalizingly in the air. It had been over a year since he'd eaten a sit-down meal, and his mouth was already watering at the thought of it. "Well, what are we supposed to do, Sheriff Walsh?" "We run a restaurant here, not an orphanage," said the short, stocky woman while wiping her flour-covered hands on her apron. "I'm sorry to hear about her parents and all, but this ain't no place to raise a child." "It would only be until we can reach someone from her family in Boston," said the sheriff. "I'm sure they'll send someone to collect her, so you'll only need to take care of her for a few weeks at most." "And what if they don't come for her? Even worse, what if there's no one there who can come for her?" protested the woman. "This place keeps us hopping all the time, and our hands are already full. As much as I'd like to help you, I'm not willing to assume the responsibility of raising an orphan child." "Here you go," said the young woman, placing the plate of ham, eggs, and biscuits in front of the hungry stranger and asking, "Would you like some peach preserves or molasses to go with your biscuits?" "Peach preserves would be nice," he answered. As she turned back towards the kitchen, the stranger said, "Hey, I don't mean to be nosy, but can you tell me what happened to the girl over there? It sounds pretty bad from what I overheard." Lowering her voice to a whisper, Luann said, "Well, her name is Mia, and she walked into town this morning. Someone found her and took her over to the sheriff's office. Apparently, her parents were robbed and murdered yesterday, and she walked all night to get here." As two additional diners entered the restaurant, the woman said, "I'll be right back with your preserves," before nodding at the two newcomers and heading into the kitchen again. "Can I at least leave her here while I send a telegraph to Boston and try to locate her family there?" asked Sheriff Walsh. "Nancy, you know I wouldn't ask if I had any other options, but you're the only one I can turn to at the moment." Looking disdainfully at the young girl, Nancy said, "2 days. After that, if you don't come for her, I'll toss her out like dirty bathwater. There ain't no such thing as a free ride here, and I ain't about to make an exception for some child that I don't even know." As he sat there quietly eating his breakfast, the stranger noticed that the young girl wasn't even paying attention to the conversation between Nancy and Sheriff Walsh. Instead, a look of abject fear was plastered across her face as she stared mutely at the two men who'd just entered the restaurant. Not only had she recognized them, but they had also recognized her, and when Sheriff Walsh left the establishment, the two men visibly relaxed, as if relieved to have thus far gone undetected. "It's none of my business," he said to himself as he attempted to focus on the delicious breakfast before him, to no avail. A few seconds later, Luann rushed past, placing a small bowl of peach preserves on his table before hurrying over to the two dubious gentlemen now seated between him and the recently orphaned child. All he wanted was to finish his breakfast, settle his tab, and get the hell out of Virginia City. After 5 years of sticking to his meticulously developed plan, he was determined to see it through without being sidetracked. Accordingly, he finished his coffee, wolfed down the rest of his breakfast, and left a very generous $0.50 on the table to cover his meal. A few minutes later, he was leaving Virginia City, en route to Reno, where he would sell the mules and the wagon before boarding a train for the Atlantic coast. With a bit of luck, he'd be back in Boston within a week. He'd gone nearly 4 miles before his conscience erected an insurmountable obstacle in his path. It didn't take a seasoned officer of the law to see what was going on in that restaurant. Those two men had either killed that child's parents, or they'd been there when it happened. Clearly, they were looking for an opportunity to eliminate the last remaining witness who could tie them to the murder. Sheriff Walsh was either too overwhelmed or too preoccupied with other murders to dive headlong into another investigation, and the stranger had his doubts as to whether the sheriff could locate the child's relatives, if he even bothered to try. When he walked back into the restaurant, the two men were standing across from Nancy, trying to convince her to turn the girl over to them. Although she wasn't very keen on the idea of adopting the orphan child, it was obvious to her that relinquishing custody of Mia to these two dubious characters would end catastrophically. "Just hand her over, and we'll be on our way," said the taller of the two gentlemen. "No one will be the wiser, and you can simply wash your hands of the whole ordeal." Nancy was a stern, but godly woman, and when the would-be kidnapper invoked Pontius Pilate, inferring that she could simply betray the little girl by washing her hands of the entire ordeal, they'd lost any chance of peacefully removing her from the establishment. Just as one of the gunmen rested his hand on the butt of his Colt 45 Peacemaker, a voice from behind him said, "Mia?" This time, every head in the now crowded restaurant turned to look, as the stranger said, "Mia, honey, I heard what happened, and I'm here to take you back to Boston." Mia instinctively knew she could trust this tall, mysterious stranger with kind eyes, and said, "Uncle Peter, you came for me." All eyes were upon them as Mia rushed over and wrapped her arms around the strange man, saying, "I knew you would be here." Since his westward journey began, he'd been as inconspicuous as a rainworm. Now, every eye in the room of this restaurant bustling with activity was trained squarely on the two of them. "How about we head over to Sheriff Walsh's office and let him know that I'll be escorting you back to Boston," said the man now officially dubbed Uncle Peter. Taking Mia's hand in his, he led her out the front door and diagonally across the street to the jailhouse. The sheriff was legitimately surprised to see the two of them entering the building, and was all too eager to accept this as a solution, despite the absolute incredulity of it. After having Uncle Peter sign an impromptu custody document, Sheriff Walsh released Mia into his care, with no further questions asked. Honestly, he was glad at least one problem had been taken off his plate for the day. After helping Mia into the hard wooden bench seat of the wagon, he turned to find one of the men from the restaurant standing a few yards away from him, with his hand hovering menacingly over the pearl-handled grip of his pistol. "Do you know who I am?" asked the man. "Does it matter?" asked the stranger, nonchalantly. "Around these parts, people call me Blink Masterson," boasted the cocky young gunslinger, looking to add another notch to his reputation. "Well, I'm from around these parts, and I've never heard of you," answered the stranger, squaring up with Blink Masterson as the two men moved slowly towards the center of the street. "Well, what should we put on your headstone, because your name sure as hell ain't Uncle Pete," spat Blink. "Here's the thing," said the stranger. "If you hear me say my name, you're already dead." The next instant, Blink Masterson's body flinched almost imperceptibly as he reached for the holstered Colt strap to his thigh. Suddenly, he was staring into the sun before a dark figure knelt over him, blotting it out completely and coming to within inches of his face. "Oliver," whispered the stranger, staring deeply into eyes that slowly glazed over, before dilating completely.